Chariot Solutions TechCast, ETE 2013 Conference Session Number 1, the JavaScript Frameworks Panel. Our first podcast from the Philadelphia Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise Conference is our JavaScript Frameworks Panel. Led by Robert Hansen, author of GWT in Action and host of our prior Web Framework Shootout in 2011, it includes developers who contribute to Meteor, Backbone, Ember, and AngularJS. Four JavaScript frameworks that cover the gamut, between all-in-one platforms to comprehensive client-tier frameworks, so strongly focused and less comprehensive and more configurable ones. The TechCast is sponsored by Chariot Solutions Education Services, providing training in Java, Spring, Scala, Hibernate, Maven, and other open-source languages or frameworks. View our course offerings and contact us about private, on-site training on the web at chariotsolutions.com/education. Let's listen in as Robert Hansen introduces the panel.
Good morning. Let me introduce myself. My name is Robert Hansen. I'm the co-author of GWT in Action. I've been a web developer for about 15 years, mostly Java and Perl on the back end, JavaScript on the front end. And this talk is the JavaScript Frameworks panel. And part of this, the idea from this comes from that there's not a lot of good information out there on comparing different frameworks. If you go to Wikipedia, if you ever look at the comparison of JavaScript frameworks, they talk about EchoJS, they talk about ACDC, Dojo, jQuery, Gwt. They don't mention Angular, Meteor, none of the newer stuff. So the question is, where do you get this information? And I really couldn't find a good source. And that's what this panel is about. So let's start off with introductions. We'll start with you and go across. Introduce yourself and explain what you're working on.
Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm Avital Oliver. Some people call me Avi. I work at Meteor Development Group. I'm a core developer on the Meteor platform.
I'm Tim Brandon. I work in Boston at a startup called Matchbox. I've put Backbone into production. I've helped contribute to the project. And I'm currently working on a new product with it.
Hey, I'm Yehuda. I worked on Rails for a while, and these days I work on Ember. I also am pretty active in a bunch of standards bodies, including TC39 and more recently TAG, and I see my work on that mostly to get more developers and developer voices involved in the standards process, because God knows there's enough browser vendors and ivory tower people involved, but I've been doing good work with a lot of other people, and I think we've been making good progress there. So Rails, Ember, and standard stuff.
Hello, I'm Brian Ford. I work on AngularJS on the core team at Google, and I'm also co-authoring AngularJS in Action with Lucas here.
Good morning. I'm Lucas Rubelkey. I'm a senior engineer at WebFilings. I've been doing an enterprise Angular application for the last year, and I'm co-author of AngularJS in Action.
Okay, so I prepared a bunch of questions, but this is really about you. If you have a question, microphone right in the middle of the floor. Feel free to step up at any time. So let me start with this. You know, I've been doing JavaScript since the 90s. Started using jQuery. It seems like everybody can agree on jQuery is a good next step. But now I want to move to a full-featured framework. What's the difference? Where's the separation point between a framework and just another library? Is jQuery a framework? Is Gwt a framework? They specifically say that Gwt is a set of tools. It's not a framework. Where's the separation point? What makes a framework?
So nobody wants to call themselves a framework, because I think in the JavaScript thought leaders have succeeded in making it a dirty word. So if you go, for example, to the Angular website, this is totally not a bash on Angular. I'm just, if that's what you were looking for, you've come to the wrong place. If you go to the Angular website, it says, we are not a library or a framework. We extend HTML. And I think that's probably the right thing to say. I think Ember says that we're a framework, but I don't think that framing is so useful because of the fact that everyone is running away from the framework label. I think maybe you could reframe the question in terms of some concrete, like something concrete that we can answer. I think specifically the labeling question is a little bit loaded.
So I want to go to something that has a lot more features than simply jQuery. What features should I be looking for?
Cool.
One thing that I would like to mention, some distinguishing features that I notice between a library and a framework are what define my project. So if I'm writing an application with jQuery, I sort of feel like I can tack it on into my project. While when I'm writing using, I use Backbone, not vanilla. I use like a lot of plugins and I add a lot of features into it, and it slowly becomes what I would deem a framework. It defines how I write my application. There are like certain conventions that we've now put in place where the application just won't work any other way. So maybe that's one way of thinking about it, is just like a library you can easily just tack into an existing framework project that you have going on.
Sure.
I don't know, it's tough to define these things.
If I might cut in, I think kind of the big difference between library and framework is dealing with lifecycle type things, you know, so switching between different views in your app, switching between different controllers. If you think about that, you don't want multiple things usually managing these same type of things. So framework is kind of this big piece on top that, you know, manages the things that you only want one thing managing. Libraries, on the other hand, you know, they might do all sorts of different things. So it's typically, you know, one-to-many relationship. You typically use one framework just because a lot of the features between frameworks are redundant. And then if you want, you know, a certain extra functionality, you plug in libraries.
You go.
I just want to be the minority voice here. I think that the this idea that frameworks are bad is kind of, I think, misleading. I think it's partly because there's a lot of competition between different paradigms, and each one wants to say, like, use mine and you can add it on. But the reality is, I think if you think about developer experience, it's actually better to have a framework or something more encompassing that just solves your problems. So I realize we're at a specific point in time now in the evolution of JavaScript where there's, like, tens or hundreds of different competing bits of technology you can mix and match. Maybe that's good for evolution, but I think it's not good in the long run, and we will see over time convergence over good platforms and frameworks.
So I completely agree with that. I'm actually glad that both Tim and Brian didn't run away from the framework label, even though their projects normally do. So in particular, the Backbone project really doesn't want to be framework. And again, this is not, I'm just trying to say what the projects are saying. And that's why I don't usually like to, I actually agree with you, Avi, and I'm glad that we're basically all on the same page at the panel here. I think that's awesome. I think it's great that and I think the answer that Brian gave about it being a framework, there is only one, right? You could run Ember and Angular and Backbone in your project and have them control different parts of your screen, but that's pretty silly. People usually don't do that. So I think that's true. I also agree with the lifecycle thing. I think one thing that you should ask yourself in general is when you're looking at a framework is what are the overarching ideas that the framework brings to bear? And I think this is probably a good thing for us to talk about in future questions, but there definitely are very specific things, like Ember is very, very focused around routing, Angular is very, very focused around dependency injection. These are core concepts, and I think you should look at these things when you're looking at a new framework, and you should say, okay, what does this framework think is the core idea that is how you should think about building applications, and see if it matches how you want to think about it. And again, I think these are, I don't want to get
well,
too
no, that's actually the next question. You know, what are the, when you go to Wikipedia, they have a nice little table and it lists all the different features and specifies what each framework supports to those features. What are the major features that are supported today and what do your frameworks support?
So I'll just continue where I yep. was, which is I actually think that the checkbox feature checking is a pretty dangerous way of comparing frameworks,
sure.
Specifically because Backbone is 800 lines of code, and it has a router, and something called a view, and something called a model, and it has a way of automatically saving your models to the server. But I think, of course, that doesn't really reflect how Backbone thinks you should build apps. And I think Ember has all those features and Angular has the features, and I think if you look at Ember and Angular, you'll find that we can check off the same chief feature checkboxes, but I think there's definitely a different design aesthetic, so I can definitely say my thing, and then I want other people to say their thing. Our thing specifically is that we think that you should organize your application around a URL structure. So you should, if you're building an Ember app, you shouldn't tack on URLs at the end. Your application state should be driven by the URL in your application, because we think that a web application has URLs, and that's how we want you to do things. So we have all the features, but that's our core.
So I think in terms of frameworks, you know, a lot of it is, you know, also where you're coming from is, I think certain frameworks are going to resonate very well or more with you. So I have a Flex Flash background. And so coming into Angular, where you actually use declarative markup to actually kind of denote this underlying, you know, composition of functionality, that made a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, coming from like a routes background, or I mean a Rails background, like, you know, kind of a route-based application, you know, Ember might really resonate for you, or, you know, Backbone, where you actually want to composite, you know, the tools that you want, or the, you know, the kind of the components that you want, you know, ad hoc, you know, that might be a good fit for you. And so, you know, for me, coming from a Flex background is, you know, kind of having this, you know, this directive, this DSL, you know, being able to do these kind of components and define them work really well. So I think in terms of frameworks, it's also, you know, what have you done, you know, previously that is going to make it, you know, the most comfortable fit for you, or, you know, where you're coming from, where is that, you know, kind of that sweet spot for you?
Can I add on to that real quick? So as a Backbone developer, like, I got into this when I was very late with jQuery, and I realized I needed to move on to something new. So I looked at Backbone, and it was something that was very easily readable for me, so I was able to quickly jump into that, and I feel like that may be where a lot of people are right now, especially developers that are relatively new to this space. But as I've been getting, you know, more and more advanced with that, I've been yearning for, you know, more. Like, I want Backbone to push more, but that's not really the design goal of Backbone. So it may be a good first step for you, but lately I've been like digging into Ember, and I've been trying to learn more about this framework, and I find that for someone who's not a core developer, it's a little bit hard to just dive right into and read the source code for. So I wouldn't maybe immediately tell a developer who wants to know how the framework works to jump right into Ember. Maybe use Backbone as a stepping stone, or try and work your application to use that first, just to kind of mess with stuff.
I think that's a really good point. I would say if you're looking to use any of these client-side JavaScript libraries, look at something like Todo MVC, where you can look at a very simple application in all of these different things. You know, it's easy in some frameworks to make something that's easy, and so it might not give you really a great feel of what it's like to build the app that you want to build in that, but it's at least a good first step. And something that I want to talk about then is data binding, because I think, let's see, Meteor does data binding, right?
Not now, but it will.
You want to do data binding.
It does a thing that is close. Appears. Yeah. When you write it, when you do a demo, it looks like you're binding your models to your reviews. And
is that just the live refresh?
Happy if I was successful.
Okay. Meteor looks cool.
I completely
So Ember does data binding. Angular does data binding. There are some
Backbone
plugins.
Backbone has like six plugins.
Yeah, Backbone has like six plugins. So I think we're all kind of converging on data binding as a really useful and productive way to write web apps. What do you guys think about that?
I mildly disagree, just because we've built applications that work just fine and we've never had to use it.
Yeah, I actually agree. I don't really disagree with Tim in the sense that people have been building applications using jQuery for a long time, and Backbone definitely provides a tool that's halfway. I think it's in between. It's not everything is raw events. It sort of feels, if you look at Backbone, it's sort of the primitive that is similar to what Ember and Angular both use. I think beyond just data binding, though, I think most frameworks have converged on the idea of declarative markup. So, for example, so Ember comes from Sprout Core, which it's a complete rewrite, but it's spiritual successor to Sprout Core. And Sprout Core was data bindings, but not declarative markup. And one of the reasons that I started over when I joined the project was I said, I actually care about declarative markup. This is a very important thing. Ember needs to have declarative markup as its core principle. We need to have templates. And I think between the time that I started with Ember, and Sprout Core and Cappuccino and YUI and EXTJS were like the popular things, I think in 2013, almost everybody says templates are the way to go, and having tools for building declarative structures is the way to go. And I agree that data bindings, Backbone doesn't push you in that direction, although there's a lot of tools for doing it, but I think everybody else basically realizes that essentially the curlies and being able to put curlies in different places and have that bind from your model into your template is crucial.
I just want to back up a little bit on what I said there. I wouldn't say that data binding is unnecessary. I would just say that, like, when you're building an application, I have not deemed it absolutely necessary in order to build something. Yep.
It sounds like a lot's going on under the hood in these various frameworks. How is the overhead with them compared to each other? Is it something where we load a page and we spend a second while the JavaScript goes through and analyzes the HTML, or is there's just not a lot of overhead in the libraries?
You guys can go first.
JavaScript engines are really fast.
That's a cop out.
You're the one that's supposed to be all about light. That's
really a difficult question to answer because every framework is a little bit different in how it lets you do these sort of things, right? So I actually started with Backbone, and Backbone is exactly as fast as you decide to make it be, right? If you use some of these plugins that, you know, maybe give you data binding, but the implementation isn't quite so rock solid, it might be slower. You know, if you write all of your views and all of your DOM manipulation from hand, you know, and you happen to know all of the little tricks in there, you can make it, you know, blazing fast. The downside there is that you're writing just a ton of code. So I think you really have to think of it as, you know, what are the trade-offs? And another important thing is, at least in Angular, we have kind of these basic data binding directives, as they're called, that let you set this up. But if you get into a case where these directives are too slow because you need to, you know, bind to a million things and do something really crazy, you can always drop down a level to the kind of, you know, event handler things and write your own components. And I'm sure Ember has some notion of this as well. And if you're using, you know, Backbone or Meteor, I'm sure, you know, you have these different granularities that you can work at. But typically, when you drop down to the lower granularities in these frameworks, that's where things can get a little bit messy because, you know, the idea is that we're working above these areas. And so sometimes these things aren't quite as well documented, or sometimes they're a little bit awkward. So I would say, depending on what your application is and how often you have to kind of drop down, you know, back past the data binding into the kind of event handler world, you know, that can vary widely depending on the framework and depending on the type of application you want to write.
So one thing that both Ember and Angular do, but Backbone does not do, and I think is crucial for the performance question, is when exactly does a change that happens get delivered? So let's say you have some simple object that has a couple of properties on it, and you make some changes, and whenever any of those properties change, you have to go re-render some piece of DOM. So the naive way to do it, so of course you could, obviously because Backbone is low level, you can do whatever you want, you can do it correctly. So I'm not saying that it's impossible. But the naive way of doing that in Backbone is you basically listen for events for changes on those properties, and whenever they change, you re-render your view. And basically what that can mean is that if you make several changes to several properties during in response to some user event, you're going to may end up re-rendering multiple times. So a very common debugging problem in Backbone is like, why is my view getting rendered so many times? And both Angular and Ember, and I think we're the only ones, but I think it's possible that there are more now. We definitely pushed it pretty hard in the beginning. Have a strategy of waiting until all the user code runs for a particular event before trying to actually go do the data binding. So if there are, especially when your application grows and there's many pieces of interconnected bindings, this happens in Backbone just as much as it happens in Ember or Angular. It's good to actually let the user code run to completion and then go take stock of exactly what has changed and what has to be reflected into DOM. Angular talks about this a lot, and I was actually, I had been talking about it a lot for a year or something, and then I noticed that Angular was, and I was very excited about it because I wasn't howling into the wind. But I think for performance reasons, now Ember and Angular both, there's some overhead to doing this work. We both make different trade-offs of exactly how much overhead, but I think that overhead pays for itself when you get into a bigger application, because trying to deal with, reason about exactly all these interconnected objects and how exactly they're going to end up updating DOM is very difficult. Right. So being sure that a piece of DOM can only get updated one time in response to a user event is very crucial.
Right. Anything else? I would say something else that's important is sometimes, sorry, did I cut someone off?
No, I don't.
Okay, all right, so the important thing here is, you know, what is fast, what is performant for you? You know, you might say you can write something one way, you know, with 1,000 lines of code, and it's, you know, a million times faster or something. But if to the user, you know, that million times faster is, you know, 10 milliseconds versus some really tiny fraction of a second, then it doesn't really matter because the user's going to perceive that as instantaneous anyway. So,
give you a little background.
Sure.
On our site, most of the pages are fine, but one of the pages, and it's for some reason the page everyone wants to hit, a huge page, very large XML, HTML, and any library we throw at it that doesn't need this advanced stuff where you do your curly brackets and tries to replace, it just takes so long, it ends up taking like 3-5 seconds to render that one page. And we're just trying to figure out what's the happy medium for for us to support all the regular pages that are passed, mm-hmm. and one page everyone hits, that's left.
Yeah, I think that you might need to adopt some sort of more modular pattern there, or maybe some, you know, you're incrementally kind of, I don't know, doing the data mining, setting things like that up. We should talk later, maybe yes. you as well. And, you know, that is definitely a problem if you have a huge page. But there are other strategies that you can use to tackle that kind of probably work even across frameworks as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically what ends up happening when you have a ton of data is for every single strategy, there's some limit after which, even if you just rendered HTML, there is some point at which the browser just simply rendering all the HTML is going to take time. And obviously, adding additional overhead adds more stuff. So, you know, obviously, you don't want 100 rows in a table to be slow, but some frameworks might start slowing down after 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 or whatever. But I think whatever that limit is, there are some canonical strategies, as Brian was saying. And I think the most common one is basically what Coco does, which is you basically have a table with a bunch of rows that are in view. You only render those rows, and you basically, as the user scrolls, you basically replace the contents as of each of the 10 rows with the items that are. That's it. Now this sounds crazy. It sounds like a crazy implementation.
It's not crazy from an IT point of view. We've been trying to pitch that. Our business is not IT people.
So, I think there are definitely, I think, so Ember has two libraries that do this, and I know a lot of other frameworks do, and I think especially when you're doing good data mining techniques. So basically, the strategy in Ember that I'm assuming would also work in Angular, someone wrote it, is we have the 10 items, and basically when you scroll up, we basically just replace what in Angular they would call a scope and what we call context with a different context, which will trigger it to re-render. And because there's only like 10 items on the screen at a time, you can re-render those 10 things very fast, even if the user happens to be scrolling relatively fast. So I think the right answer here is that all the frameworks need to get libraries that become more battle-tested that do this particular technique for people that have huge amounts of rows.
But this sounds more like a runtime problem rather than the loading initialization. Are you seeing the slowdown when you first load the page?
Because
so that has nothing to do with scrolling.
No, sure, it does. So it does, because if you're only rendering 10 items, that's going to render very fast. But if you have to render 1,000 items, that's going to render very slow.
But then how does that have anything to do with your scroll performance?
So the problem is that if you only render 10 items and the user starts scrolling, you sure as hell better do something so that they don't see.
But there's tons of ways of going through that. But that has nothing to do with the initial loading is what his problem is. And I see a lot of people have problems with the way that they architect their applications, where they don't have a proper build process. So they're compiling their templates as they go versus doing it at build time. So maybe there's a number of other optimizations that you could possibly make that maybe have been investigated yet.
Tim, I'm confused by what you're saying. So my understanding was that so there is a general problem that I thought was the problem that he was talking about, which is that just actually rendering a template for a lot of data takes time.
Yeah, the initial rendering, we've gone through multiple libraries, and that's kind of why we're trying to figure out what libraries.
And if your problem is that rendering 1,000 rows or 10,000 rows is slow, not rendering 1,000 rows or 10,000 rows will be faster. Unfortunately, if you don't render all the rows, you have to now deal with the fact that you haven't rendered all the rows, and that's the strategy.
So let me shift the discussion a little bit.
Can I just point out something?
Yeah.
I think there is a correct general solution to this, which may not be addressed by some of these client-side frameworks, which is render HTML on the server and then bring your page to life. And my understanding is, like a lot of big projects at Google, they have their own internal systems that do something like this. Right now, Meteor doesn't support this, but we will support server-side rendering. So the initial page will be ideally fast, just like every old-school server-side framework, and then will come to life at the speed that maybe it'll still take a few seconds for it to become interactive, but that'll at least make a page load be quick. So that may address what you're talking about, but that doesn't work right now yet.
Yeah, I think all of us are actually working on that. I think the problem though is that, especially depending on how resource constrained your device is, having 1,000 rows at all might just not be what you want.
Yeah, those are two orthogonal concerns.
Yes, confirmed.
So, but with these single page large applications, is there a way to dynamically load additional code into the browser? Like GWT, you can now break your application into smaller parts. When somebody clicks on a link or goes to a certain page, that code is activated, it then loads that code from the server. So it only loads from the server what it needs.
So for what we do, we actually load Dojo into our Backbone application to take advantage of a Gantt chart that is in, I believe it's called something like D-Grid or something like that. We don't want to load that on the initial page because very few people are actually going to click into that. It's an additional like 36 kilobytes of code that we just don't want to execute. So we use require.js, and that does have that ability. It's a little bit messy. It's not the most ideal way, especially since it basically becomes callback hell versus having like a synchronous looking require. But it's definitely possible. It's not a feature of any one control framework, as far as I know. I don't think any of these frameworks actually deal that.
Meteor has.
I don't know about delayed loading JavaScript.
Yeah. But for us, it's just the loader that you choose to use. And there's plenty of loaders out there. A lot of people have philosophy that that's not how you should do it, that you should always build all of your JavaScript together. And that's a big part of Browserify, which is another module loader out there. I've gone to arguments with them several times. But if that's something that you're looking into, it's just don't abuse it. That's the one thing. I see a lot of people abuse it. They get very paranoid that their application is going to get too large, when you can have easily over a megabyte of JavaScript raw source that will gzip down to like 40, 50 kilobytes. You know, it becomes very low. It depends. It can be that good.
100 or 200.
Well, we have a lot of redundant wrappers out there that add a lot of weight to our files, and when it gzips down, all of that gets eliminated. So it all depends. I mean, in my talk later on, if you guys are interested, you can see how about half a megabyte goes down to 40 kilobytes.
So how do you deal with reusability? You know, you're creating these JavaScript libraries that you want to reuse in multiple projects. How do you address that?
AMD.
AMD?
The asynchronous module definition is what jQuery uses and what Dojo uses. I'd love to see more libraries push and start using this. I bet Yehuda has some stuff to talk about this, because I spoke with Tom Dale, his partner in crime, and they were talking about how perhaps they will go the ES6 module route that could compile down to AMD. The problem with AMD is that it forces a way of writing your code using a specific wrapper set, and you kind of have to buy into this mentality. It's not exactly fair. It's great that some libraries and frameworks have already done this because it makes them truly compatible. I can pull in only the pieces of Dojo that I want. Dojo is a ginormous library framework. You know, it's massive. But now that it's written with AMD, I can pick out only the pieces I want and compile those into my application. So it's got a lot of benefit. So
yeah, I don't hate AMD. I hate writing AMD modules. So there's ES6 is the next version of JavaScript. It has in it what is rapidly converging on a final module definition. And I think the thing that's really awesome about the ES6 module definition is that it's syntax, which means that when you just parse the file, you can figure out what your dependencies are. But that syntax lets you not have to write a wrapper. So basically, the way AMD works is you have a define block. It says what the dependencies are, and then you have to have a function, which is another level of nesting, to stop the JavaScript code from getting executed until the loader wants it to load. But of course, with syntax, you can avoid that entire problem. The strategy that I've been using is basically to use that syntax to compile into AMD, as Tim was saying. So basically, I get to write something that looks like a nice synchronous require. The syntax stops you from doing crazy stuff like if something, then import this file, which you can do with require, and introduces all kinds of problems. So basically, having something that looks like a nice synchronous import, but is actually compilable down to what I think Tim is correct is the predominant module, the predominant point of interoperability in today's JavaScript. I think that's what I'm doing. But I think no matter what, how exactly you're getting to AMD, getting to a point where you are able to import modules from AMD and maybe export if you're writing a library AMD, I think this is good. This is a good thing, but I think it is important for the people who advocate AMD to be thinking about solutions that make it not as painful to write. I was against AMD for a long time just because I didn't want every single one of my files to have define, parentheses, array of stuff, comma, function, curlies, another indent, one or two indents. I hated that. But it turns out that there's alternatives that give you the same interop without needing that, and I think that's good.
Does Meteor address this at all? And I'm not trying to pick on you, but Meteor is very different from the rest of the
I'm going to be honest, I'm kind of confused by the conversation. I'm actually not totally, I don't follow AMD, I don't know what these things are. I mean, I've heard of them, but is all we're talking about how do you load JavaScript after your page is done loading? Or,
yeah.
Because these seem to be concerns about how you define the modules and how they define dependencies and such.
I think they go one and one. Like they're handed.
It's not one and one. I think there's two orthogonal points. There's how do you actually load all of your JavaScript, mm-hmm. and then how does it look? And I think, of course, you can write a thing that is not sort of the standard way that people do it, and then as long as everything is inside of your ecosystem, many solutions will work. I think the reason why AMD was successful was that they managed to persuade many library vendors to create AMD exports, and what that means is that if you're Ember and Ember happens to support AMD, then great, you can import jQuery as an AMD module, you can import underscore as an AMD module if it happens to be an AMD module or whatever. But if you're Ember and you happen to have an Ember specific thing, so Dojo switched to AMD, right? Dojo used to have their own thing, and that was in large part just for interop. So I think the interop is the important bit, right?
I think the stuff you're talking about has to do with the fact that you're talking about client-side frameworks, so you need to have a standard. With Meteor, there's a build process, so it seems, if I may be mistaken, that we could integrate AMD or whatever other standard into our build process, end up generating a bit of JavaScript that takes care of all the dependencies, and then it's just one JavaScript file on the server that you can load with the async script tag or something. Is that not correct?
I think you would have to... The answer is roughly yes, but you would have to actually do some work, and I think it would be worth your while to do it.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah?
If I was to design an app to be used in a normal browser, to be used on a tablet, and also in a smartphone, I want to use one of these frameworks to do it. What are the design considerations that would go into how to architect that application in each one of your frameworks so that I could reuse as much as possible to each of those different devices?
Anyone want to take this?
I mean, we've written one backbone application that worked on mobile, and our design considerations were mostly surrounding around how do you make the application responsive. Didn't really affect the JavaScript so much as it did on our CSS and some of the HTML considerations that we had. So I can't really speak too much to how anybody has really focused heavily on that, but maybe some of the Angular guys or Ember guys know of any of their apps that were... anybody who's built apps using their stuff.
So at WebFilings, we actually built a large Angular application, and so you have an editor and a viewer portion of it. In the viewer portion, we actually wanted to actually run on a tablet, and so we wrapped it in PhoneGap, and it actually worked really well. We had to make no modifications to the JavaScript per se. I think the design considerations come in from like a UX UI standpoint, is actually designing the visual elements to work on a mobile device. I think we used Bootstrap and, you know, their responsive, you know, bits that they had, and that worked really well. Is really ultimately it came down to the, you know, making it a pleasant experience. And so just from a design standpoint, that was it. But surprisingly, you know, we didn't have to really make any modifications to the framework or, you know, anything like that. So that's actually a really cool thing about JavaScript and kind of where we are now, is that you can actually target a lot of these devices and you're not having to, you know, jump through these fiery hoops to make it work. Is we didn't have to do anything.
You wanna? Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, that's basically the same experience that I've had. So there weren't really any special considerations from the JavaScript side when I was building, you know, one of these either mobile web or kind of PhoneGap wrapped mobile web applications. Really, the big considerations are going to be design and, you know, if you use too many fancy CSS3 things or, you know, gradients or things like that, sometimes that gets a little bit slow on the phone. But in general, mobile browsers are actually really super awesome now.
Yeah, I would say I agree with everything everyone said. One of our biggest contributors to Ember is basically a mobile app company. It's really great. I would say that as a practical matter, the main consideration is the device is more resource constrained. So that was sort of along the lines of what Brian was saying. You might be able to get away with putting 1,000 elements on a page on a desktop, and you know, tablets are close, but phones in particular really have much, much more tighter resource constraints, and you might have to reach for more of the tricks and hacks to deal with keeping your DOM smaller or keeping your CSS saner more quickly than you would on a desktop or a tablet. So I would say, if what you're building is like conceptually like an iPad or iPhone app, you're probably fine. It's probably already designed to not put too much on the screen at once. But if what you're building is like that gentleman's app, which has like a huge list of data, you're probably going to have to think about whether the phone or tablet device might want a different UI for dealing with that large amount of data, both from a design perspective, but also just from how many resources could this device actually handle.
One other thing I'd like to mention here is there's a new plugin that came out called the AMD feature. This comes back to that AMD module stuff. It allows you to do feature detection at a configuration level and then dynamically at runtime swap out which module is actually included. So this comes back to that whole weird wrapper that you have to do with your modules. By having that level of kind of like abstraction, you can at runtime dynamically swap out what happens. So a good example that they put on the GitHub README is detection for iOS. And if you're not on iOS, you get an Android module instead. It's kind of a poor example. It's not definitive. It's kind of like if you're on iOS, you get this module. Otherwise, everyone else gets the Android one, which isn't obviously accurate. But it's kind of an interesting concept that's coming out with these module loaders, how you can do like at a feature detection level, swap out which one happens. So it's like a dropdown that you might have. Maybe it looks slightly different on iOS and it's functionally slightly different on iOS. You could actually dynamically at runtime swap that out. So it's kind of interesting. I'll be talking about that during my talk as well.
Questions? All right. So recently, jQuery 2.0 came out, replacing 1.9. They're going to keep 1.9 going. 1.9 is still going to support back to IE6. 2.0 starts at IE9. And the reason they said they did that is for both size and performance. So my question is, it sounds like that a lot of the frameworks that you guys are building are still going to support at least IE7, maybe 8. Does that impede the performance? Does that slow down performance for other browsers that don't need those hacks and shims?
So I think a useful thing to say, and I you guys could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this also applies to Angular, is if what you're doing is building on top, so first of all, Angular doesn't require jQuery. It has its own mini jQuery. Ember uses jQuery as the core. But once you have that abstraction, whatever it is that is your DOM, you've mostly already handled all the browser hacks. The number of things that in Ember or Angular or Backbone or probably Meteor, I'm guessing, which is literally like trying to work around browser bugs, actually turns out to be low outside of the core functionality that something like jQuery provide. And I think if you look at jQuery, really wasn't saying, so I was part of that decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think there definitely was a goal about size and performance, but I think part of it was just, it looks like old IE isn't going away very rapidly, but it actually is kind of important that we be able to start moving forward as a project. So what can we do? We can say we're going to have an API compatible thing that works on all browsers, but for new browsers, we're going to stop doing some of the more obscene hacks. And I think that just makes it cleaner. It allows us to improve velocity of the project. But again, I think the important thing to say is that jQuery, the reason jQuery and other abstractions like jQuery are so awesome is that they do, in fact, abstract the annoying problems from DOM from us. So when it comes time to build like a data binding abstraction, that is already done. It's not like if what you're doing is updating an attribute, hopefully you're using an abstraction that already deals with any weirdness around updating attributes, but you're just conceptually updating an attribute.
So does Ember still support IE6 or?
So Ember technically supports IE6. I don't think it would be performant to run Ember on IE6. But Ember basically doesn't use any features that are not found in ES3, which is IE6 plus, and it uses jQuery as its core abstraction. So I think there is a high likelihood of more bugs in IE6.
Has anybody given up completely on IE6 support?
Yeah, we've given up on IE6 completely.
Yeah, I think Angular's given up on IE6. It's just not a lot of fun to deal with some of those bugs. And
Microsoft gave up on IE6.
Yeah, I think Microsoft.
Well, I think Angular has a different thing.
Yeah. I'll talk about that a little bit. So part of one of the interesting things in Angular is we have these directives that kind of attach new functionality to different DOM elements. And in order to make things like our routing system work, we actually attach behavior to things like anchor links and what have you. And so we do have to do a little bit with browser hacks ourselves, outside of just kind of the jQuery Lite abstraction. But in general, the story isn't that bad until you get to IE6. So we've said, all right, no more IE6. I'm not sure if we test IE7, but really IE7, IE8 are usually, if you have IE8 support, you're usually good on 7. You know, there are just a few tiny gotchas, but I know we test on 8 and above for IE. I would say if you have to write a JavaScript application for IE6, or that targets it additionally. I mean, working at a jQuery level, it might actually be the solution for you, because the overhead from these frameworks might be just a little bit beyond what IE6 can reasonably handle. I mean, IE6 is really slow.
The biggest thing for us when we were testing our new application was we're only going to support browsers that can actually sort of render it the way it should look. So I think many of the issues we would have if we ran our modern application would be CSS and possibly some kind of the markup that we're doing. Yeah.
What about Meteor?
Yeah, we've basically given up completely on IE6. I mean, maybe there are some apps that still need to use it, and Meteor will not be the right solution. And IE7 is kind of like we have the official, unofficial policy of maybe supporting different parts of IE7. We kind of change our minds over time based on how hard it is. So over time, it'll disappear, and we officially don't have an official policy about IE7, but it mostly works.
So one of the things that I've always disliked about JavaScript development is the testing, because there's just way too many browsers to test them all. How do you go about testing if you're putting out frequent releases? How do you go about testing? What types of tests do you run? Do you use services like cross-browser testing that'll take snapshots? What do you use?
All right, let me tell you about testing in Angular. All right, we really, really, really like that question from the Angular world, because that is one of the biggest pains in developing front-end software. So AngularJS is designed completely with testability in mind, and we actually write our own test runner, now called Karma, previously called Testacular.
Good work.
Thank you. Thank you. And so the way that we tested is we have this test runner written with Node, and what happens is it kind of starts up this web server. You point the different browsers that you want to test to this server, and then the test runner runs all the tests on the browsers and reports it in the command line, or you know, spits out some XML or some tap or something like that. And so that's how we've addressed the problem. We have a couple little helpers, and you know we've mocked out parts of the framework so you can easily test like your controllers and your other various parts of the application in isolation. But then we also have support for end-to-end testing, where you test the whole stack, or integration testing as it's sometimes called, and we think that's really big. And you can use Karma, our test runner, with really any of these frameworks, and so I'm hoping we see more collaboration around that.
Yeah, I totally agree. So actually, a bunch of Ember people have been playing with using Karma before it was renamed. Using Ember, it's working really well. I think I definitely applaud Angular's evangelism of testing. I think they have done a good job of telling people that testing is important. We have done a very bad job of that, even though we basically have the same philosophy of how our internals work. So basically, instantiating, I think the key question for isolation testing is, can you instantiate a controller without the whole system? And the key question for end-to-end testing is, can you reset all your application state and start over if you want? Basically, Ember and Angular, and depending on how you write your backbone, I'm never going to speak for Meteor because I don't know enough. But I think we all do this. And I agree that I think, to be perfectly honest, the only reason why we had not done more work with Karma beforehand is that we were like, we do not have the energy to be trolled for the name. But now that the name is now that the name is better, I think so people had already been using it internally a lot. So we use it, and there's been a bunch of Ember people. I agree that having a canonical solution, and again, I applaud Angular for actually taking the initiative to evangelize. It's really great.
I had done training with Backbone for a while, and a lot of times our students would ask us about testing, so we had to add, a section into that, so like a 3-day trainings type stuff that we did. And that was the hardest part for me. I feel like this is a severe problem with the Backbone community in general, is just that a lot of the articles and posts that you see on testing Backbone test the internals of Backbone without even knowing it. So they're testing whether or not their model gets initialized, whether or not this route gets triggered. These are all tests that are already in the Backbone harness. So it's really hard, I think, to find the right information out there about how to actually do this. And I had a really good conversation with another developer named John K. Paul about testing when we were coming back from jQuery Toronto. And some of the big things that he was talking about when you test an application are the fundamentals, the crucial points that make your application, making sure that those work. Whether or not someone can actually log into your application is probably a good thing to test. Whether or not some internal piece of your framework actually works is probably not as useful. So those are some of the tidbits. So like when we did our training, we mostly talked about people testing the crucial bits and not testing the internal bits of the framework.
I'll say the Meteor's testing solution is not yet sufficient. We have internal unit tests with our own framework for the framework itself, but if you're writing an app and you want to test it, we don't actually have a full story. People in the community have come up with all sorts of patterns for doing it using other tools like Jasmine or some of the other ones. And I think it's just important to note that there are two different types of tests. If you're going to write a full UI app test, then I think that all this discussion is kind of beside the point. You just want some system to go and like click on things and then verify that the UI is correct or whatever it is you want to verify, and then you do want to do some multi-browser testing using one of the existing tools, like, I don't know,
Browser Stack.
Yeah, we use that for our testing whenever we do a release. But and then you also want to have unit tests for your app to verify that your models do the right thing or whatnot. And there we don't have a story, partly because our model and controller story is not yet complete, so it would be premature for us to set up a testing environment around those. But basically just to point out the distinction between internal unit testing and end-to-end UI tests.
So also I think another important thing about actually testing, you know, JavaScript as a whole is this actually goes back to a talk that I heard Yehuda give at Strange Loop 2 years ago, is actually pulling the state out of your DOM. And I think that's one of the problems that people have previously had, is they get state in their DOM and then it's just really hard to test. And so by separating your declarative markup with your imperative operations and having that clean line, it gives you more testable surface area. And I think that's absolutely critical to writing tests. I think also writing JavaScript in a functional manner so that your functions become more pure, that you can then, you know, run through and test things without having side effects as well. So being able to reset your things. And so, you know, kind of adopting more of a functional mindset is going to make you a better JavaScript developer. But also, I think the most important thing is, you know, separating your declarative markup and your imperative functions. And so just, I think making that small, you know, kind of paradigm shift a little bit from your old jQuery applications to kind of these new modern frameworks is really going to go a long ways to increasing your surface area, reducing friction, and, you know, writing, you know, more tests.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think one nice, so I think all of us, when we've been talking about imperative, declarative, whatever, it's been a little abstract. So I think concretely what we are meaning is, let's say you have a controller and whenever some function gets called on it, it goes and modifies state on itself. So when you're writing a unit test, you don't actually have to wire up that state to some data bound thing in your template. You can actually just say, I want to test that when this function gets called, this piece of state on the controller gets changed. And now, hopefully, assuming that your Angular or Ember or Meteor or whatever system is set up, Backbone as well, actually, as long as you're as the bindings are set up correctly, you can basically test that via end-to-end testing or some other thing, but you don't have to, hopefully you don't have to be like staying up at night, hopefully my binding system is working, right? So if what you're doing is basically just testing that whenever this happens, this state changes, and separately you're testing, you know, when I click on this thing, it fires this function, then you actually, like you said, there's a lot more surface area to test without having to worry about, okay, I clicked on this thing and really what I'm checking is whether some data attribute got added to some DOM thing somewhere.
So I was reading something about Ember in particular, and it seems like that most Ember developers are Rails developers. So is that sort of like a core audience? I know as a Java developer, that's why I joined up with Gwt. That's why I looked into that. I'm a Java developer. It's really easy, the transition. It seems like if you're a Node developer, Meteor work sounds great. As a Java developer,
what?
Meteor,
I feel like if you're a Node developer, you might care about NPM.
Yeah. We have NPM support in the release. It'll be coming out probably in a few days.
Awesome. I'm just saying right now, there's no... Anyway, I don't agree with that assessment. It's not the case that Ember is targeted largely at Rails developers. There was actually... So we have a discourse forum, a public discourse forum that we use, and there was a question recently which was like essentially the same thing. It seems like a lot of people use it with Rails. What else are people using it with? And there was just like dozens of people that were like, I'm using it with Java, I'm using it with PHP, I'm using it with whatever. And I think one of the big differences between things like Sprout Core and things like Ember are that we really restarted our effort around being a good JavaScript citizen. I think everyone is doing that, other than Meteor, is really around being just a JavaScript library without a lot of tooling dependencies. I think everyone a couple years ago was like, tooling is really important, because once you get into big app territory, it's like, must have tooling. Tooling is really important. And I think everyone realized that, you know, even though that is a true fact, it's basically a massive barrier to adoption whenever you're like, you have to get this tooling set up before you can use your thing. I think Meteor has done a good job of making that not as bad as a lot of the other solutions a few years ago. But I think what has ended up happening is that things like Ember, things like Angular, things like Backbone have ended up really, really decoupling, and like maybe to a fault decoupling from any server-side solution. The only sense in which Ember is at all Railsy is Ember data wants you to have a particular, in order to get the drop-in experience of Ember data, you want to have a particular JSON format. So it's pretty much a standard JSON format. If you looked at it, it would look like a pretty reasonable thing. But you, if you're using something other than Rails, if you're using Rails, you can install a plugin that I wrote and you get that JSON format for free. If you're using something other than Rails, you have to say, okay, I'm going to build a JSON, and it's like you put the name of your model as the parent key, and then if you have associations, you have foo, colon, and then an array of IDs. It's like pretty normal JSON format, but I think there's been a little bit of work to make integration with Rails, for sure, and I think that maybe confuse. I don't even think so. I think the confusion comes from the fact that I worked on Rails. I think that's the root of the confusion. Yehuda worked on Rails. Yehuda works on Ember. I've heard that there's a thing called Ember Rails. Probably that means that it's coupled. There are basically many, many people use Ember with Node as a server, and it's very productive for them and many other servers.
I did find some resistance when I was talking with some core Ember people before about using modules, and a lot of them found that my philosophy and the way that I developed was not in line with the Rake asset pipeline. Do you have any comments on that? Why there was so much resistance?
I feel like
that
I'm crying. I think that's maybe a mischaracterization of what might have happened. So I wrote a tool called Rake Pipeline, which is basically a system for defining a pipeline of tasks. So if you're doing compilation, let's say you're writing CoffeeScript, one way to do it is every single time anything changes, recompile all of your files. That's basically what happens in Grunt. I use Grunt, but I don't like that. And what I did is I built a tool that happened to be written in Ruby, because I write a lot of Ruby, that basically is designed around building a pipeline. So first compile your CoffeeScript, then strip out asserts, then minify it. Right? And basically the idea is that as long as your original file didn't change, then you're not going to have to do all those steps to get to your final build product. And if, you know, maybe a few of your files change, you can reuse the old output of the previous steps. So I wrote this thing called Rake Pipeline. It really has nothing to do with modules at all. And I think at the time, I also built a thing called Minispade, which was like a very, very tiny, like 10 line loader, which was designed for working with concatenated files and getting good output out of source URL. So this is getting very technical, but I don't think there was anything about modules per se. And in fact, we are, I think we're doing more to adopt modules now. I think that a year and 2 years ago, the ecosystem was actually pretty broken in general. And I think we were doing what we knew worked. But I think as the ecosystem has gotten better, as Grunt has gotten better, as AMD modules have gotten more adopted, as ES6 modules have come out, I think we've been moving in the direction of something that is more standardized. And I think a lot of people were ahead of the curve, and that's kudos for them.
I didn't want to seem like I was attacking you. I wanted to give you a chance to defend what I had perceived when I went through there. It was a very difficult conversation. I felt like I wasn't talking to the right people because it was like a very one-sided argument. Like, yeah.
I think the TLDR is the whole thing sucked a year or two ago.
Yeah. I wanted to just address kind of in a broader sense this question of, you know, does this back end work well with this front end? Basically, at this point, if your thing speaks JSON, everything will be okay, right? Doesn't matter, you know, which front-end solution you're using or which back-end. Really, the meeting point is JSON. So as long as you speak JSON, you're fine. And it's almost impossible now to find any sort of platform that doesn't support JSON in some way.
I also wrote something called Backbone Boilerplate to address some of these issues. Very early on when I was using Backbone, I found that it was very frustrating to not have this canonical way of building my application, canonical way of running my application during development. So there are some lacking tools here that I feel that is still a problem.
The only problem with that is that there's, you know, 20 million backbone boilerplates that are also...
how many of those 20 million come with...
Yeah, and there's... I mean,
the problem is that they don't come with...
No, I wasn't trying to take a shot.
Sure, sure. I would like to just differentiate why you would want to use mine versus 20 other million.
Right, I mean, I have the same problem.
You guys need to hug.
I've written like four of these myself, so I know.
But you agree that in most cases you do need something like this? This is actually a good... probably point of discussion is whether or not you need some sort of boilerplate startup for
right.
your framework.
Well, yeah. I wanted to plug a project that I work on called Yeoman, and this works with Angular, Backbone, all sorts of things, Bootstrap. It'd be cool, I don't know, Meteor, have you guys looked at it all?
I've not heard.
We should talk more about it later, but the idea is take all these different kind of boilerplate setups and make it so it's really customizable. So you can, you know, choose library X with framework Y, and you know, just all of these different combinations of things, and still have the kind of best practices and these sort of things set up. So that's a really difficult problem, yeah. And it's something that that I'm really interested myself in solving. So we should talk more about that later, I think.
Yeah, I've spoken with Addy several times about Yeoman.
So. Yeah, I was actually really excited about Yeoman when it got announced, and when I tried to install it, there were like 50 dependencies. No, seriously, when Yeoman was announced, I was like, awesome, let's make sure the Ember generators are awesome. Let me install it. And then several hours later, we were like, and I'm a Ruby guy, and one of the dependencies is Ruby, which I don't understand. Anyway.
That's not the case anymore. But
awesome. That's great. That's great.
Really so bad. A year ago.
I am not. Yes, exactly. I'm not bashing at all. I think we should, if things are better now, we should definitely resync. I think in the same way that Karma is a good central meeting point, I think having a thing like Yeoman is a good central meeting point. And if Google wants to pay for it, that's awesome for me also.
So let's take some questions. We only have a few minutes left.
So this is actually a question. Something that surprised me using Angular. You had mentioned JSON as the meeting point, and it really kind of surprised me when I threw a post to the HTTP service and was getting JSON instead of form URL and code. Is that kind of where things are going?
Yes.
JSON up, JSON
question, please. The question is... Sorry, awkward. The question is, I was using Angular and I submitted something using the Angular dollar resource service, and it was sending JSON and getting JSON back, and I was confused because I thought the thing was URL encoding, and is maybe where we are now JSON instead of URL encoding, and I said yes. And I think, does anyone want to disagree with that?
JSON is the only thing.
Yeah. Yes. The one takeaway. That's it.
How do we file upload?
You don't use JSON for
Yeah,
file
you don't you don't use JSON for file upload. That's
good question.
All right, so you got us. You got us. Very good.
Just to set the context about all the different frameworks, I'd like to hear your thoughts on which frameworks you would use together. So for instance, I'm hearing that Ember and Angular and Meteor and Backbone are probably all more in competition with each other. I probably wouldn't use both. Or a combination of them. I probably would pick one of those.
It's interesting.
And I believe I could probably use jQuery and Dojo and Prototype and all the little JavaScript libraries.
I would not do that either.
And then where does underscore versus Lodash or one of those, where would that fit in?
So
I'd like to hear which combinations you guys would use and where you think you fill the whole niche.
All right, so that's...
The others and where you would use the others.
That's a good question. The question is, you know, how can you combine these different libraries and frameworks together? Like which ways are valid, which ways make sense? And I think you can take something like underscore and you can use it in basically any framework, right?
Yeah.
We all agree with that? Yeah, so I know a lot of guys that develop with Angular, they love underscore, they like these utility functions, and so they throw that in there. And underscore is actually kind of one of the main things that makes Backbone awesome. So I would say if you're using underscore and you don't want to use Backbone, like there's obviously no reason to include Backbone itself on top of underscore, on top of Ember or what have you. So typically you would choose only one of Angular, Ember, Backbone, And then Meteor is kind of its own class of things. You have to kind of buy into the whole front and back tied together thing, if I understand.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you, I saw a slide that somebody gave, I forget where he listed all of the different bits and components that a web app might be built out of, and there were like 10 columns, each one had like 10 rows. A lot of people are excited about that. There's a lot of new ideas floating around, but the reality is that's actually detrimental to developers because every developer has a different understanding of some constellation of bits and frameworks and components. And we actually think this is a problem, and we're trying to solve that by actually creating a seamless integration between these and not having the developer have to choose which bits they use, but basically say, these all work together well, and this is how you want to do it. So we totally diverge from what I think a lot of other people think about this.
I think only Backbone has the philosophy of like, go pick your whole thing together. I think everyone else has converged. Everyone else who calls himself a framework in some stripe, in some context, has converged on the idea that somebody should be creating an integrated whole. You shouldn't be like selecting your own router and then figuring out how to select a data binding framework and then maybe some model, some HTTP abstraction, right? I think everyone's on the same page. I think there definitely is an upper bound there. I worked on SproutCore for a little while. That was too much. That was too much integration. And I think even Meteor wants to have packages built by the community. So it has a highly touted Meteor add feature, which lets you, I don't know, maybe that changed with the new version. But I think, I don't think most people think that you should have a large constellation. And I think most people would agree that if you have, even having to choose between underscore and Lodash is hopefully not a long-term situation. Mm-hmm. But I think most people would agree that, I think most people would agree to some level of integration, but not the whole hog. I think even Meteor.
So I think I'm very agreement then that I probably wouldn't use a combination of Ember and Angular and Backbone. I would choose one of those.
Sure.
But then I'd probably use underscore with any of them.
Yep.
How about Twitter Bootstrap and Knockout? Are those additional alternatives to Ember, Angular, and Backbone? Or
those are completely different things from each other.
Yeah, so that's... So Knockout, I would put it on the same level as Angular, Ember, Backbone. Twitter Bootstrap is mostly just a styling tool, so you can, again, you can use it with any of these. Basically, the idea is framework is you get one of those, and then libraries, you should be able to plug in basically any library to add, you know, new utilities, new features to any of these frameworks, and something like a CSS grid framework or one of these style frameworks, you should also be able to use whichever one you want, and maybe even multiple. I don't really know what the story is like there. But you know, those are all kind of different things. So again, one framework. So one of Knockout, Angular, you know, Backbone, Ember, or you know, Meteor. Again, Meteor is you get the server as well. So that's you have to take that into consideration. But from there, it's that's the only part that you really have. You know, this exclusiveness. From there, you can kind of choose from, you know, the whole universe of crazy JavaScript stuff.
I think that may be able to change with this advent of AMD, and hopefully when Ember adopts an ability to bring in AMD, you can mix in. Okay, that is awesome. It's already built in, apparently, which is great. I'll have to look into how I can start utilizing that. The reason I bring that up is because we are using something like, you know, we're using Backbone, and we mix in a little bits of Dojo. We're not bringing in the entirety of Dojo. That would not be the wise decision. It's you wouldn't bring both of those in, but we can bring in pieces of Dojo that we want to use. I feel like that may be one of the only projects that's doing that right now, that like maybe that's the exception, not the rule. Most of the time you have one.
Well, I think it's important.
We're down the wire.
Oh. Hey, yeah, no problem. I think the important thing is there's only one URL bar. So if your framework, if you have a library that is managing the URL bar, then certainly you if you use Angular and Ember together, they're going to compete over the single resource of the URL bar. I think there's things like the Ember object model or Dojo's graphing that you might want to use, but at that point, those things are really just libraries that happen to be under the umbrella, the integrated whole that was built, and maybe if what you're saying about Meteor is true, then it's probably also true about Meteor that you can grab some pieces and make use of them separately. And AMD is, I think, a good meeting point for those things.
Exactly.
So one last question.
My thing is that I've used most of these frameworks, I've not used any of them, but I find that they're very easy to integrate when you're developing a new application or adding features onto an existing application. But in terms of when you already have a large JavaScript application that was built a few years ago that's mostly based on jQuery. Are there any strategies that you would use to try to integrate or maybe incorporate some of these frameworks? Because I find that that's where I have the hardest time.
Right. So if I might start, at least in Angular, we have this idea of, sorry, what was that? Oh, repeat the question. What do you do if you have kind of a large jQuery application that you built a couple years ago, and now you want to use one of these new frameworks?
And you have about 60 seconds.
All right. So in Angular, you kind of have this root element that says this is where the Angular application starts. The same with Ember, same with Backbone probably. The idea is if you wanted to transition one of these frameworks, what you do is you kind of carve out a little spot and you start there. You say, you know, my application, my Ember application is just this little box here, you know, this little div here, and the rest of it can remain the old jQuery style, and then you slowly, you start moving things in there, you start kind of, you know, growing that out, and you kind of refactor as you go. So there are strategies for it. I don't think that there's anyone that's written extensively on that, so that might be somewhere, something that, you know, documentation or, you know, that might be another topic for discussion, but yeah, blog post or something. Yeah, if you want to do that, please write that, tweet that out to us.
I did some consulting for a company that had this exact same problem, and that was the recommendation that we gave them. Start with a small piece and then work your way up.
Yep. So regardless of what framework you choose, that sort of strategy is pretty good for slowly migrating.
All right. We're going to have to end it there. Thanks a lot, everyone, for coming.
Thanks again to our panel members and moderator for running the panel. We hope you find the information useful. You'll be hearing a number of podcasts from ETE over the coming months on the TechCast. You can also view our screencast on the ETE 2013 show by visiting our Emerging Technologies website, emergingtech.chariotsolutions.com. Leave us feedback on our podcasts and screencasts. You can tweet and reference us as @TechCast, or leave us email at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com. Our podcast themes are free themes number 3 and 4 from podcastthemes.com. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.